Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. On today's program, we will discuss youth journalism and the hashtag MeToo movement with Jamie DeSilva about her newest article on the MeToo movement. Please stay with us. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. We are broadcasting from lovely Hayward, California, where the freeways are always jam-packed. Our intern, Claudia Bestrain, is here to tell us who is going to be on the show.
Yeah, I'm Claudia Bestrain with the Media Freedom Foundation. On today's program, we will discuss youth journalism and the Me Too movement with Jamie DeSilva and Daniel McGuire of the Pioneer Newspaper in Hayward, California. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to www.projectcensored.org, where you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows and show your support for Project Censored. You can also rate and like us on iTunes. If you would like to reach the show or have us discuss something on the air, please send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Your feedback can also be directed to Twitter. Nolan's Twitter is @Nolan_Higdon, or to Nick @DrDreadlocks, or to Desiree @Des_Blacktivist.
All right. Thank you very much, Claudia. Way to go. Okay, so again, I'm going to keep telling you folks, I want you at the College of Marin, October 26th, 27th. We here at the radio want to see you out there at the College of Marin, October 26th, 27th, 2018. Come visit us. We're going to be there as part of the conference. The whole radio crew will be there. We love meeting people and hanging out and hearing from everybody. We've gotten positive feedback on our recent show, so it's been quite an exciting time, and we hope to get out there and meet you all. We're to get started today. There's so much stuff that's been going on in the corporate media for the last month or so we wanted to chat about. But I really want to talk about the Me Too movement because we have Jamie DeSilva coming on later. And after that, we're going to be talking to a Pioneer newspaper reporter, Daniel McGuire. And DeSilva wrote this great piece on the Me Too campaign. And it seems to be this growing movement, just women's rights in general, is this growing movement during the Trump campaign. And it seems to be this what looked like a background issue that just continues to eat away at this administration on numerous fronts. And so, of course, we had the story just recently about Rob Porter stepping down from the White House after over a year of being on temporary security clearance for allegedly abusing two of his wives, right, and one of his girlfriends. That's why his security clearance was blocked. And the White House gave him a security clearance, and they really only decided to let him go after the Daily Mail reported on this story. Of course, at the same time, he was also dating Hope Hicks, the communications director, the 30-year-old sort of powerhouse of the Trump administration in communications. And what have you guys thought about the coverage? One of the things I noticed about this, there's a real story here, an opportunity to cover the abuses women go through. Also the fact that these women, by the way, went to the FBI, at least one of them did, and told them about the abuses. The FBI did nothing about it. The White House did nothing about it, just as the police had previously done nothing about it. So women they're speaking out basically to the press. And so there's often this sort of like moniker, right, of like, why do women speak out to the press? It's the only avenue they have. The only people who seem to be listening are in the press. No one else does. But that's not the story that the corporate media seem to be covering in the fallout. Instead, it was national security, right? He could have been blackmailed by this story. The Russians could have used it against him, and he has security clearance. Although I find that an important story, I think it really distracts from the issue, and it's just kind of another example, like the grab-em story of Trump on the campaign trail, as well as the women speaking out against celebrities. I think it always kind of distracts from how the structure and the culture creates this environment. We end up talking about something else.
Yeah, I think to some extent, this is the year of white men behaving badly. And one of the things that I think we're seeing is, you know, just like when JFK came in, you got the whole Harvard crew that moved in. We've got a whole crew of angry white men, apparently entitled and angry white men, who have moved into the White House along with Trump, another entitled angry white man. Again, I put those two together because I'm not really sure why he's that angry. But he is, and a part of that is that there's a litany of abuses going on here. People, Steve Bannon's had problems with respect to spousal abuse, Porter. It goes on and on and on. It's clear that they didn't vet that they didn't think that that was important. And the fact of the matter is that if you're operating from a 1950s sort of Mad Men perspective, it isn't important that you beat your wife in terms of that being possibly an event that would disqualify you from federal service. It is now, and there's significant pushback. I'm hoping that this actually translates into some real political action amongst American women as we head into the midterm elections. I was moved, you talk about media coverage, I was actually moved by something that Lawrence O'Donnell did on his program when Porter's ex-wife began to post on Twitter, and it was a very passionate "and I stayed" hashtag, where she talked about, hey, he went to counseling, and I stayed. I had a baby for him, and I stayed. He destroyed my sense of self-confidence, and I stayed, etc. And there were, O'Donnell read the tweets in response to that, with other women talking about why they stayed, and some women talking about why they didn't stay. One of the ones that struck me was that there was testimony on Twitter from a woman who said that she was holding her child in her arms and her husband punched her full in the face and there was blood over that spouted from her nose on her child. And she said that was it for her. That was the last day. After that, she got in the car and she drove away and that was it. And I find this super empowering, and in the sense that it's really coming from the ground up, right? This is not a top-down thing. Women are speaking to the abuse that they're dealing with and really powerfully critiquing all of the thugs that he has put into the White House.
I have to agree with every point that you've made, Nick. Eloquent as always. One of my biggest issues, I guess, with the media coverage would be with that "why I stayed" hashtag. That's something that is never really brought up for
right.
the victim. You know, right. everyone's just like, oh, please leave. You got to do what you got to do to keep yourself safe. But it's not simple.
If it were, it
wouldn't go on for 5, 10, 15, 20 years to
That's
the
right.
point where you physically and emotionally cannot leave because this person has destroyed you. And the media fails to make these men truly villains for that. You have destroyed a single life, and if you have children, it usually trickles down, and then you start the next generation of victims and potential abusers.
Mm-hmm.
But then also what falls on the victim-shaming side of, again, why did you stay? One thing I've been really curious and kind of waiting for is, especially with these White House administrative staff, what is their severance package? That was a big talking point with Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes, and it's, oh, great, he's out of the White House, but how was he compensated for that? Because I know that you don't generally just walk away from a government job with nothing.
Yeah, well, especially not in this government, you probably walk away richer than when you showed up. But I think that the what you're hitting on there is a good point. This talks about media infrastructure. I think the corporate media is not built with infrastructure to talk about these issues. It is an old boys club reflected by Harvey Weinstein's or Rupert Murdoch's, right? Those empires, those types of empires are what create news in America. And so I think you can't really expect them to have these conversations, unfortunately. I don't say that as a negative. I say it as an opportunity to say, one, turn those things off. But two, what alternative forms of media are out there. We always have this like all or nothing mentality about technology, right? It's either the greatest thing since sliced bread. I don't eat bread. Or it's the worst thing ever. But I think there's some middle ground. I made a career out of talking about the problems with media and digital technologies. But there's also positives. I mean, the way that social media is connecting women to feel empowered to tell these stories, to try and paint a picture for all the ignorant or naive people of the world, men, I think that's a really powerful statement. So I think there's something examination in there of they're circumventing sort of the corporate narrative through these digital technologies. I say that not because of one story alone, but because it's been a sustained media movement right in the face of being ignored, blockaded, or dismissed by the corporate press. So I don't know how others feel, but I'm pretty optimistic it's going down the right path. I don't think you do the touchdown celebration yet, like it's changed something. But as far as maintaining itself and sustaining and making an impact, I'd say it's looking pretty good. Would you agree with that, Amy?
I'd say definitely. There finally is a platform for which we won't be silenced. I tend to kind of fall on both sides of the fence. I don't find it as empowering as these women have to re-experience their trauma, their abuse, and their personal experiences. And it can be really helpful, and it can also be really harmful. Again, like you said, with technology, it's either the greatest thing or the worst. you can have the same response with emotional abuse, sexual assault, things like that. But I do love the idea that, as you said, you can circumvent the narrative that typically victim shames, and you can take back that power.
Yeah, I mean, the goal is dismantling patriarchy, wherever it stands, whether it's in, you know, the movie industry or in government or wherever it may be. When I was watching Lawrence's program, it struck me, too, that in a number of the tweets that women were putting out there in response to Rob Porter's ex-wife, that women were critiquing the church also, priests that were sending them back home to be with their husbands. There was one where a woman mentioned that the police were called over to her home, and policemen looked at her. She was beaten, and the policeman looked at her and said, if I was married to you, I would beat you too. And then it was another 20 years before this individual was able to get out of that house. So you know what these women are speaking to are all these structures of male power, policing, the church. Frankly, even in a certain generation, if you showed up on your parents' doorstep and said, my husband has beaten me, your parents are going to send you back to this person. All of these different structures of patriarchy that push you back. I was also struck, too, sort of perhaps maybe a more minor issue, of the critique of Quentin Tarantino, the actress who played in Kill Bill.
Uma Thurman.
Uma Thurman, who was talking about the abuse that she took. For example, a scene where Michael Madsen needed to spit on her, and Tarantino didn't think that Madsen could pull it off, so he did it. He could actually pull it off. Then there was that car stunt that she was asked to perform that has resulted in continuing back problems and injuries for her, where he just said, hey, you got to get in here and that's it, you got to do it, and she crashes and she's dealing with these injuries. I think that when we finally start peeling back the layers of what women have been experiencing at the hands of vicious patriarchy, it seems almost untenable, you know, impossible, if you will, to survive in that kind of environment, to thrive as an actress or even as a mother under those kinds of threats, constant institutional and personal threats.
Yeah, and I want to add one more element to that. So President Trump himself, as well as his cabinet, have said how nice Porter was and how they did not expect this type of thing. And Trump even went so far as to say he's very sad and wishes him well, and noted that he did a good job. This is always the issue, I think, that really wedges this, is that a lot of these guys probably are nice on the surface. They're probably really nice at family events. They're probably really nice in the workplace. That doesn't make them innocent, right? So you have to sort of square
the circle. Sociopaths are nice. Sociopaths are nice. They appear as very charming individuals. They get jobs. They get high positions, potentially even going as far as the presidency of the United States. That happens. So it is not inconsistent that Rob Porter is a nice guy, but also goes home and beats his wife.
So at the time of this recording, I want to say this because I have a feeling it's coming. Hope Hicks supposedly was in a relationship with this man. I hope there's not going to be victim shaming for Hope Hicks.
I do too.
I already heard it starting to come up with how she was the one who drafted the statement about his stepping down that the White House read. I already heard the inroads starting to be made there. My plea is, whether you're anti-Trump, pro-Trump, whatever, don't go after Hope Hicks in this.
I agree.
We'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. We are joined now by Jamie De Silva, youth journalist and blogger with a background in communications and media production. She identifies as a hashtag activist And she's here to talk about her new article from The Pioneer called Hashtag Activism Brings Awareness to Different Movements. Jamie, welcome to the Project Centered Show.
Thank you, Dr. Hagman, for having me. Good afternoon. How are you?
Doing well. It's always a pleasure to hear from you again. Definitely a friend of the show and enjoyed working with you over the years. So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about your article, what's in it, and where they can find it?
Okay. I've written it for the Pioneer newspaper for the Cal State East Bay campus. And a little bit about the article itself, where it kind of stemmed from, was the Harvey Weinstein situation and just the hashtag movement that went with it all on social media. So I kind of took that and wanted to look at that a little bit further as to, I think, the first day that Alyssa Milano had tweeted about everyone putting it on their status or on their social media, and it being 12 million people, and then it just kind of took on from there. And so I think that was something to talk about, as there's 12 million people and then some continually using the hashtag and using it to support, to raise awareness, to create conversation, and kind of looking at it a little bit further as, does it help? Does it work? Does it use all the tools necessary for the platform to propel any of these movements a little further? I think a lot of people got confused with hashtag MeToo specifically, where a lot of people thought it was Alyssa Milano who started the hashtag. I think she just kind of brought awareness to it, but it actually was the back end. It had been going on for 20 years. I think a lot of people were surprised to hear that. So in the article, I speak a little bit about Tarana Burke, who started it 20 years ago, Me Too and Just Be Inc., and dealing with women and men who had suffered from trauma over the years from sexual assault.
So Jamie, we refer to you as a youth journalist here, and you refer to yourself as a hashtag activist. So do you want to describe for our audience what those two things mean?
Sure. I think anyone who will say that they're a hashtag activist who, I guess, to support any movement or any type of situation that's going on with hashtags, that they're either looking at petitions or signing petitions or on the web, on the internet, on social media, that have specific topics that they can relate to and are supportive of, and they use the social media platform to hashtag or make announcements or use the social media for type of stories or anything like that to help that movement specifically to kind of propel to the next part of the movement or to keep it going.
Jamie, this is Dr. Baham on the line here. I'm wondering, you mentioned that the Me Too movement is about 20 years old, and I'm wondering, in its 20-year origin, what is or has been the relationship between women of color feminists and European-American feminists? Unfortunately, we do have to acknowledge that there is a little bit of a split there. I think that's very unfortunate, but it's very true. And I'm wondering if that Me Too movement, just sort of if you can assess how that Me Too movement has played out in both forums, amongst women of color feminists and European-American feminists?
Absolutely. I do think, like you said, unfortunately, there is a divide there, and that has been the criticism of hashtag MeToo in general, that it's not incorporating all women of color, specifically that there was attention made when it was a white, wealthy actress who made a statement, and then she had to back up saying, this isn't mine. Let me turn it to the person who it belongs to, which is Tarana Burke, who is African-American, and I don't think there's a lot of attention made to women who speak up that are women of color until someone who is white who's in a place of power or wealth that they're able to point at what's going on, such as even with hashtag Time's Up. It was written by a Hispanic woman who was a farm worker for the last 20 years all up and down Central California, and it was written by 700,000 of them, sent it to Times Magazine, and it wasn't until Reese Witherspoon, who's an actress, who then took that and then kind of solidarity wrote a letter back to her. But no one knew that until Reese and her group got together. So I do think there is a divide, and I also think I don't think they're very well represented. And even on award shows and whatnot, women who are in the industry then take women of color of certain situations or certain movements, like Tarana Burke, and they kind of parade them down a little bit of down on the red carpet, feel like we need to look at where the problems are coming from, their topics, and where they're coming from, and who's originating them, who's spearheading them, and not just white women who then kind of take that and then help the situation, if that makes any sense.
Hi, Jamie. This is Amy Casey here. Thank you for joining us on the show. I had a quick question just backpedaling a little bit about your hashtag activism. With a conversation like this, it's definitely brought the discourse to the forefront of the media, although it has been whitewashed, as you've acknowledged. What do you see the next steps as being for those people joining the Twitter realm, you know, and supporting the cause? What's the next step beyond that to really get some change going? Or is that kind of beyond your realm?
You mean for anyone who is participating in the hashtag activism?
Correct.
Okay. I think at this point, I think, it, like you said, it has brought on a lot of critical discourse, but I do believe that at this point, there should be a lot of places to find, like, where you can volunteer to donate your time to make a difference, to really get out there and make a difference. Now you can set your, I support it, there's awareness, there's conversations to be had, but actually act on that. I think that's the next step of that, because it's constantly going. It's just it needs to be propelled a little bit further to make the actions concrete, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, Jamie, I think the comment really resonates. That's always one of my critiques about a lot of social movements, looking back historically. They skip the step of building an awareness campaign, and they take to the streets. And so they lose a lot of supporters who are unaware there's even a problem, either because they're naive or ignorant or whatever. So I think something like a hashtag campaign can build that awareness. But you're right, it needs to be followed with action, disruption in the streets, which then can hopefully turn into policy that is then enforced.
So I think
that's a great point on that. So out of curiosity, being a youth journalism, so a young person who takes part in journalism, because especially my lifetime, journalism has just been sort of mocked in its inability to inform the public or deliver concrete messages or facts. So as a young person, what inspires you to get into journalism?
I think for me it was just telling the stories that need to be told, the stories that haven't been said, or to the people to connect with that don't get a voice. I think more or less that people that don't get the voices or the chances to speak their truth, and or certain situations that don't get to be seen or heard, that people would be really surprised to know it actually goes on.
Yeah. Are you finding yourself enjoying journalism? Do you enjoy the activities, sort of the mind-numbing, like interviews and protecting sources and writing? Is this an enjoyable activity?
I do. I absolutely do. And it wasn't a first love of mine, and then it's kind of gotten into kind of a love for myself that I really enjoy it.
I mean, I didn't mean to describe journalism as so boring. I'm sorry.
No.
I love journalism.
Yeah, but I like the conversations, the connection, the just, you know, connecting the dots to certain things, since everything's pretty interconnected in some way. And so it's just kind of nice to kind of know what is going out there. And it's always surprising, because as soon as you think you know something, you don't really quite know. There's more stuff out there that you didn't know.
Jamie, this is Dr. Bayham. I want to ask you a very speculative question, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
I mean, we talk about how hashtag activism is contributing to or helping social movements, whether that's Black Lives Matter or now with the Me Too movement. But is there how far can we take this? Is it possible, in your view, to build a political coalition and possibly even a political party out of this? In other words, is it possible that we could use social media to create what might be, in effect, a woman's party in this country?
I would believe so. I think that would be the first to happen. But I do think so. If the momentum is strong enough, the societal pressure is at a boiling point, I think so. I think there could be a possibility for that, yes.
Well, that sounds very encouraging. Very encouraging.
I think, I don't know how Amy feels about this. Well, I'm interested, but I would be quite confident that a women's party or feminist party could be large enough to take away votes from the other two parties.
I would believe that too.
And I think it's one of those issues you can coalesce around, because everyone theoretically has a mother or a sister, right?
Absolutely.
Partner, girlfriend. So I can see that.
Absolutely. And to that, I think just maybe a little bit of maybe some positivity on that is just that how many women took to the streets the last 2 years for the Women's March?
That's right.
World round. Just alone was it was the biggest march ever recorded of attendance all around the world. And I think with that in its lane, I think will be just in general, just definitely a big positive note that could be a possibility in the future.
I want to ask you, too, movements that are surrounded around that. You mentioned the march. And I'm wondering what is your assessment of the whole pussy hat movement, the use of the pussy hat, and also, frankly, the anti-state movement, which we're now getting, the hashtag anti-state movement, which we're getting in response to Rob Porter and his abuse of his first wife.
The hat, I never took part in wearing the hat, but I like the hat. I think it's a great idea. Even when I was in any of the marches, it was awesome to see men wearing them, women wearing them, the kids were wearing them. Well, I'm sorry, what was the hashtag you were mentioning?
The And I Stayed hashtag. I don't know if you have encountered this yet. Have you?
No, but about why they stayed.
Yeah, so Rob Porter's, we were talking about this earlier, Rob Porter's ex-wife posted a very passionate tweet about why she stayed. She mentions all the things that happened in the various stages of their marriage, him promising to go to counseling, so she stayed. She had a baby, so she stayed. He brought down her self-esteem to such a significantly low level, and I stayed. And so many other women chimed in with the reasons why they stayed, reflecting both the personal and institutional patriarchal pressures to stay in abusive marriages.
Right. And I think that's a critical point, too. Hashtag MeToo and Time's Up, too, and to some degree of a lot of women, or just in general, these hashtags have gotten a lot of criticism as to, well, why are you speaking now? Why now? It's been 30 years, 20 years, this, that, and the other. And to that, there's a lot of reasons why women stay in certain marriages like that, and or people who have been victims of sexual assault who don't speak up. There's a lot of reason to that. People just think, well, you should have just said that right now, or why didn't you say anything to then? There's a lot more that goes into that. There's a lot of fears that go into it, and so I think that is a great next hashtag to come through that, because it's not just, it's not so clear. The line is not clear on that, and when you should say something, why you should say something, there's a lot of fears that go into it, so it's not a clear line. So I think that's a good hashtag to come through.
So, Jamie, just because I'm a nosy person, what are you working on next? What articles can we expect from you next?
I am writing an article on a review of the movie The Post that just came out with Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, but more or less kind of looking at the comparison between this film and the other films that have gone on to tell the story about the woman, Kay Graham, who owned the Washington Post, right, and why it was so different, whereas the back end of a woman at that time was not really want to own a company, let alone a newspaper, run her own business, start a business, have a job title such as CEO, et cetera, et cetera. And to look at the back end of that time frame, her in this big situation where she was the one who reporters did their job, but she was the one, and I'll be all to say, run the story. So that's a big thing that she chose to do that in a time when everyone in the room, being males, told her not to because they thought they were smarter than she was. And then ultimately, great things came for the newspaper there.
That sounds really fascinating.
Yeah, Jamie, we actually have been doing a series of film reviews. They're really older films about creeping fascism. And we're sort of midway through that process. But I'd like to invite you on the air to talk about The Post, frankly, somewhere in the near future, and maybe do a segment of Nick's Flicks with Jamie.
Sure.
About that.
That'd be awesome. I would love to.
So, Jamie, before we let you get, where can people find you? Do you get Twitter, Facebook? What's your social media? What's your email? Where can people find you and your work?
My work. Facebook, Jamie DeSilva, and then on Instagram, JamieDeSilva823.
Awesome. So, and they can find your work at The Pioneer, correct?
In The Pioneer, yes.
All right. So you're not going to be a stranger to the Project Censored show, right?
I won't be a stranger.
All right, Jamie, keep up the amazing work. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
All right. We'll be back after this short musical break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts, Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III, and we are talking about youth journalism. We are lucky enough to be joined by Daniel McGuire. He is a communications major at California State University, East Bay, and a staff writer for the Pioneer newspaper in Hayward, California. Daniel, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. So our listeners and myself are very interested in what's going on with the youth in terms of journalism. It's such a transformative industry now, and you're getting into this. So tell us all about it. What interests you? What are you seeing? What are you doing? All those kinds of things.
I'll start with a little bit of background, but I first got interested in journalism because I was taking a media and government class with our communications department chair. And it was during the Trump-Clinton election, and a constant theme of a topic of conversation in that class was how the corporate media, it pretty much has more or less been bought out. They prioritize
profits over, yes, over reporting, right?
Yes, that's what I was trying to say. So they prioritizing profit over journalism and quality journalism and the truth was something that I had a problem with. And at that point in my life, I had no idea what I wanted to do with my communication degree, and found news writing rather than academic writing as a bit of a passion.
You don't want to manipulate public opinion as like a PR person?
Not quite, no. that we have enough of that at the moment. But I found passion in that, and Dr. Cardars, our department chair, was really helpful in helping me get my foot in the door in the journalism sense. I took the print workshop with a couple respectable faculty members, and then with you as well.
So how important is that at school for a young person to have sort of a strength network like that? Because a lot of schools have newspapers, but you really need faculty who have a pathway for you, as well as students who are engaged, right? Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So that was your experience?
It was. There were a lot of faculty members that were really supportive in getting that journalism ball rolling, I guess I could say. I had only an experience with academic writing at that point, and all of my experience of journalism up to then was through corporate media, which is, well, flawed. So it was nice to get a renewed sense of what journalism is and how to do it honestly and with quality.
I wonder if you share my opinion about this. This sort of just kind of want to open up an intergenerational dialogue with you. It's my belief that, perhaps just because of age, that the news, you shouldn't make any money. That news media should not make any money. I don't even know if it should break even, frankly. And I'm fine with the notion of news losing money for a particular network, which you know is going to be made up in other programming, whether it's sports or entertainment or whatnot. And I just kind of wonder from your perspective as a younger person, what is your take on that? Do you take issue with news making money? How do you feel about that?
I guess from the perspective of someone trying to become a journalist, I'd be okay with it because I like to eat and have somewhere to live. But with the way that the media is now and the condition it's in, I don't think they should be making, the larger corporations, at least I don't think they should be making as much money as they do, considering a lot of their journalism, in my opinion, doesn't matter. I guess referencing the whole concept of junk news, a lot of things that are covered aren't of that much importance compared to what should be talked about. So if that's the quality of the journalism we're getting, then no, they shouldn't be making a profit or breaking even. But
yeah, it's always kind of the bait and switch, right? They promise that corporations run things more effectively. Well, by that definition, we should have one of the most informed societies in history. These conglomerates are making billions of dollars. So theoretically, shouldn't that lead to like one of the most informed? But it doesn't, right? As you're pointing out, it leads to sort of fodder about this and that and not actually an investigative journalism.
Mm-hmm. It's like what James Brown said, talking loud and saying nothing is essentially what we've got. And we've got much more information and much more access to different sources than we've ever had before. And yet somehow we know less in terms of the fact-based information that we need in order to make judgments through the course of our day. And I wonder for you in particular, as a young person, how difficult is it for you to make informed decisions that you need to make about your life, your potential educational and career choices, based on the lack of information that you're actually getting from the media?
Well, it does become difficult to make informed decisions because I feel like the only time I'm given actual facts, evidence, or the truth is when it can lead to potential profit to be given that information. when it leads to ratings, basically. So it gives me a limited sense of information to make my decisions off of, and a biased bit, perspective of information as well.
Mm. I had a quick question. I think it's about two parts, so stick with me here. I was curious, as far as you entering this journalism communication degree major, entering the newspaper, based on just kind of general circulation and reception from your peers and your social circles, do you see in the future the for-profit model changing in your lifetime?
Maybe not in my lifetime. It seems like it's a bit of a slow burn for this whole profit-driven model to change.
And do you think that's based on the current establishment?
That's partially part of it, in my opinion. My generation seems to be helping a lot, especially with social media and technology as it's advancing, giving us a much larger platform for our opinions and our ability to form them.
Well, I do have a follow-up on that. So I you kind of what the two of you are talking about there is the model and structures of how journalism works. And I noticed this increasingly, like Trump was able to say, when he one time said, whenever journalists say, sources say, that means it's fake news. And I realize how absurd that comment is, but I was thinking about it, and I was like, most people probably don't realize how absurd that is because they don't know what journalists
right.
do. So I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about the journalistic process and sort of the ethics associated with journalism as to why you have to write sources say rather than John Smith says or whatever.
I personally haven't used that in my journalism yet, because everyone I've interviewed has agreed to go on the record and have their name used. But there has been a story I wrote for The Pioneer about the water quality on the East Bay campus, and there were a decent number of faculty and staff members that were fine with going on the record but wished to remain anonymous. So rather than saying faculty member who wishes to remain anonymous, sources say it works as well. So it's less about protecting the person rather than is maintaining contacts and maintaining that trust between your sources.
So why is that so important?
Well,
maintain that trust. Why do you think that's
they're
so
your,
important?
They're your source of information. So if you falsely represent them in your journalism, then they're not going to want to, well, help you anymore. And basically it just maintains healthy relationship with people that are giving you information.
So describe like the journalistic ethics behind that. What are the ethics behind being a journalist? Like what ethically stops you from interviewing one person who you know is going to give you the answer you want and running and printing it and saying sources say?
Aside from the bias involved in that, I could write about any very biased or left opinion that I want and just find the people that I know will give me the answer I'm looking for. What I'm trying to do is tell both sides of the story. It's a bit of a cliche I've come to learn, that just it's talking about, oh, I need to get one side and I need to get the other. There's always more than one angle or more than just two sides of a story. I'd also, quick to address the ethics that you mentioned, there's also one of the ethics that I try to focus on is not causing harm with my journalism. I'm trying to either report objective information so that people can become aware of an issue, or provide a little bit of my opinion within that, also not make anything worse than it was before.
Right.
And speaking of two sides of the story, it seems to be sort of a Rashomon effect in media, that there are alternative realities. So there's one story that's being told, for example, about the Russia investigation by MSNBC, and then there's another story that's being told about the Russia investigation on Fox. On one, you would think that we're prosecuting Hillary Clinton, and on the other, it seems to be fairly imminent that Trump may actually be prosecuted. Somewhere in between those two stories may well lie the truth, but it's very unclear how that happens. How do you feel about that? That sort of living in a world where you have these alternate realities happening through the news media?
I feel like it plays a lot into how we've been, I personally feel like I've been raised to think in terms of black and white. Our form of government is referred to as left and right. Someone is either always right or wrong. There's never a happy medium. Of course, I feel like it's obvious that someone is going to try to paint the blame on Hillary Clinton just because it takes the blame off of Trump and distracts from what's actually going on with his investigation. But it shows an obvious conflict in the way that the media works, because they're so focused on talking about what people will pay attention to rather than what's important or what's even truthful.
Yeah, I think really, if I had to pull something out and say I'm writing a book on it already, on things that are hamstringing journalism right now, partisanship is one of the big ones, because we've been able to make facts partisan in a sense, and to the point where you have people like Donald Trump, right? He can tell his supporters what is true and what is false. The Democratic Party does the same, by the way, for its people. And I say not that these, not necessarily they're always lying, but followers or supporters take the intellectual shortcut and be like, well, if Democrats support it, it must be right. Or the same thing for Trump supporters, right? If Trump supports it, it must be right. We don't get that nuanced discussion. The biggest example I saw of this, I knew everything was moving worse and worse partisan. I never thought child molestation was partisan. I always thought we agreed on that. I don't know why. I just thought for sure that was an issue we all agreed on. People are chanting how Roy Moore lost in Alabama. He still won 48% of the vote. There were still 48% of the people who said, nah, I'd rather have a child molester than a Democrat. I mean, that's a massive statement to make about partisanship. So as a journalist, how do you keep up sort of the optimism of I'm reporting facts objectively, I'm trying to get messages out there, even though I know there's some people who are just going to simply ignore the facts? How do you keep that kind of optimism?
I operate a bit under a belief that even the most stubborn people can be convinced if they're repeatedly nailed with the same information. People will have their various reasons for denying the evidence that you give them, but if it's presented to them enough and it's dug deep enough into their skull, they'll eventually sleep on it. They'll start to actually think about the topic of conversation and maybe eventually start to formulate a new opinion or at least question their own. I don't try to convince people that my opinion is correct or tell them that theirs is wrong. I just introduce to them a new way of thinking and hope that they'll sit on it and think it over. With using that mentality, I do believe that everybody, even the most stubborn people that would rather have a child molester than a Democrat in office, can eventually be convinced.
Well, that's an excellent point. I know that that would definitely influence my vote. I have to ask, personally, with you working, you know, with the Pioneer newspaper, I don't want to ruffle any feathers, but as Nick was alluding to earlier, there's, you know, multiple sides to a story, and you can pretty much pinpoint each station in corporate media, what the narrative that they're trying to spin or to plant into one's mind. Have you had that experience working at, say, the Pioneer, where there's a particular story or topic that is implied or maybe directly asked to be portrayed as one way or another? Or is it more broad and you draw your own conclusions to tell the story?
I've experienced that it is more broad and we're allowed or encouraged to put out our own opinions and as they are without manipulation, but we do have a bit of a left tone with our journalism just because we live in Hayward. There's a lot of people with a more leftist opinion and political sense. It does have a bit of a bias to it, even though I don't see a lot, but the editors and the faculty staff members that are involved with Pioneer do really well at encouraging people to just either objectively report, just give the facts and nothing more, or if it's opinion-based journalism than to do so with their own opinion, but while still addressing the counter argument for their opinion.
Yeah,
wonderful.
I think that, and that's critical to note, because we still have this sort of romantic idea of absolutely objective journalism. Everything has a slant or bias. The only, I think, crime is when the writers either trying to get you to adopt their bias, or they try and hide their bias by claiming to be objective. Just the very fact you pick a story, like you talked about water on a campus, right? That shows your bias, that you think that is an important issue and you think that's an important issue worth reporting. So there's nothing wrong with that in my view. What would be wrong is if you tried to claim it was absolutely objective and, right, this is the most important thing and everyone knows it, right? So I think that always gets lost in the debate. Like another intellectual shortcut people take is, oh, that's bias. Well, yeah, of course it is. But how does that affect the facts involved in it?
Yeah, I see a lot of that bias in examples of journalism that I read, and it's still addressable in objective journalism, like you said. I mean, the Pioneer has a Trump tracker where they talk about the latest thing that he's done or legislation he's trying to push or repeal or whatever it is he's doing. And during meetings, the Pioneer staff talk about how, you know, this is meant to be a purely objective representation of what Trump has done. But you're allowed creativity in the topic of his administration that you choose to discuss. So you can keep that bias and show that bias or your interest in what you're writing about while also remaining objective.
Hey, that reminds me, Nick, are you voting for Trump in 2020?
Well, you know, I'm thinking, I'm weighing my options, as it were. Yeah.
I like that open-mindedness there.
Yeah.
Never know what might happen.
Not really.
I wish the listeners could see the smirk on his
right,
face.
It's a very broad smirk on my face. Yes, absolutely.
I hope we just cut that clip out on YouTube and just play it everywhere. But
Nolan, you bring up an important point. I mean, our elections are you know, we haven't done anything about the security of our elections. We need a vigilant news media around that particular process alone, let alone the gerrymandering, let alone those instances where they're taking voting machines out of certain districts. We need a watchful news media that keeps their eye on all the shenanigans that we might see. Because if the House doesn't flip, even though the House is predicted to flip, what may have affected that, if that should happen? What would affect the Republicans remaining in control of both houses of Congress? Would that be further tampering from the Russians, a combination of that and voting machines and voter ID laws and gerrymandering? You know, what's going to happen?
It's a good question. That's why I like to have guests on, like both Jamie and Daniel, and bring them to our audience, because I've been sort of voicing that I think two institutions failed America in 2016, and that was education as well as journalism. And seeing young people sort of take the reins and try and fix these institutions to better serve democracy, I think, is an inspiring story. So, Daniel, we appreciate you having you on the show for that.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Danny McGuire is still sitting in here. We're going to go through the news and stuff. And Daniel, before, you know, I even forgot to ask, where can people find you and your work, get a hold of you on, like, say, social media or web pages or any of that?
Primarily use Facebook. I can be found on there as Dan McGuire, and my work is found on thepioneeronline.com.
Cool. All right, great. Again, just killer interview. So, Amy, we are Project Censored is a organization that looks at fact-based journalism and celebrates the work they do. We try and bring alternative narratives to the corporate media, and Amy Casey is here to tell us more.
This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories we are working on. From Syracuse University, Jeff Simmons and his student, Nina Goetz, have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled, Animal Activists Stop Hiding Their Faces. The article notes the bold strategy of no masks, no regrets, all the risk, newly employed by animal rights activist group Direct Action Everywhere. The group rescued a calf in Fresno, California without masks or obscured visuals to expose the poor conditions of the livestock as well as directly challenge the industry and its safeguard ag gag laws, which can be used to prosecute those individuals. This story is available at projectcensored.org. From the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Allison Butler and her students, Xander Manning, Jessica Picard, and Jared Yellen, have also nominated a validated independent news story titled Model Mississippi Curriculum Leaving Civil Rights Movement Out of School Textbooks. The story reports the failure of the new social studies standards adopted by Mississippi schools in 2011 because all the state's 148 school districts rely on textbooks published before the model standards appeared as part of their social studies material. In a state deeply immersed in the state history of the civil rights movement, the movement remains a footnote, if not entirely omitted, in current curriculum. This can be found at projectcensored.org. In another validated independent news story, this time from San Francisco State University, Ken Burrows and his student Camila Janik have published PhoneGate, French study finds 9 out of 10 cell phones exceed safe radiation limits. The article describes the recent findings of the National Frequency Agency of France that indicate that 9 out of 10 cell phones exceed government radiation safety limits when tested in the way they're actually used, next to the body. The research corroborates other studies conducted by the Canadian Broadcasting Company as well as our own FCC, in which radiation levels reach as high as 300% more than what manufacturers claim. The full story can be found at projectcensored.org. At the Global Critical Media Literacy's webpage, gcml.org, Dr. Rob Williams and his student Braden Davis from the University of Vermont have released Facebook Live, Helpful or Horror Show. The article examines the societal cost of the live function on Facebook as it has been abused on many occasions to provide an outlet and platform for acts of extreme violence, which are accessible to all 1.5 billion users. Also at gcml.org, is PG-13 the new R? Exposing the MPAA's conflict of interest. This article, written by Dr. Julie Frechette and her student Connor McCall at Worcester State University, examines how movies that are rated PG and PG-13 today contain more violent and sexual content than the same ratings did in the past due to multiple conflicts of interest for the Motion Picture Association of America and its subdivision, the Classification and Ratings Administration. Regardless of how society views the issue of violence or language, the film industry's ratings are inconsistent and contradictory, forming a double standard based on special political and ideological interests by the MPAA. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/radio. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. I'm Amy Casey, and that's the news that didn't make the news.
All right, thank you very much, Amy. And we have our intern, Claudia Bestrain, in here to tell us more.
I'm Claudia Bistrain with the Media Freedom Foundation. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to www.projectcensored.org, where you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows and show your support for Project Censored. You can also rate and like us on iTunes. If you would like to reach the show or have us discuss something on air, please send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com. Your feedback can also be directed to Twitter. Nolan is @Nolan_Higdon, or to Nick @DrDreadlocks, or to Desiree @Des_Blacktivist.
All right. Thank you very much, Claudia. And so, Amy, you've read the news. You've interned. We're going to be able to hear you hosting soon, right?
Hopefully. Oh. I will be joining Mickey on the other program for Project Censored as his co-host. So I am really looking forward to that. I've always admired Mickey as a person and the Project Censored director. And having worked with you and Nick, I feel like it's time to move on.
I don't know if our listeners how well they know this. We usually split about two shows a month each, right? Mickey and his crew do two shows. We do two shows. And you started out as a news person. Now you're going to be hosting the other shows. This is great news.
I know. It's really wonderful. I was always nervous, of course. But now that I've gotten more comfortable and more confident, I think I'll be a great addition to that. And I'm looking forward to working with Mickey and learning lots from him.
I am.
It means you're going to definitely have a Twitter handle.
There's, I know.
There's no way around that.
Yeah. I'm working on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do we have anything in the running as of now? Anything we can possibly test with our audience?
I do, but I'm not ready to reveal it quite yet.
Oh, you're going to hold us in suspense.
Yes.
Secretive.
This is what happens to them when they move up the ranks and they go to the big leagues, from the minors to the majors.
It's going to be Nolan Who tomorrow.
Who is this guy?
What are you talking about? Who is this guy?
He was in the minor leagues. Yes. I forgot about him.
That wannabe down there in Hammer. Yeah. All right. Well, Amy, we've enjoyed having you, and we're definitely going to have you back on the show and keep in touch and all those sorts of things.
Oh, definitely.
That is assuming that we can afford her in the future.
Yes. Yes. Assuming you'll answer my emails.
Right.
Someone will contact you.
Either you or someone within your former price range.
Yes.
Talk to my agent. All right. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my wonderful co-hosts, Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are executive producers and hosts. Our intern was Claudia Bestrain. Mitch Scorza is our amazing director and engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. from Maui to Manhattan. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcenseredradio@gmail.com. Do send us an email. We love hearing from you. And visit our website online at projectcensored.org, where you can find the archives of all the radio shows of the past 7 years, as well as 40-plus years of news that didn't make the news. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks to our guests. We'll see you next time.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own my special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy, where the promise of a legacy, a spirit